Do you schedule and host events in the Jewish community? Conferences, webinars, local events? Please consider adding your events to JCast Network's newest project, the Jewish Communal Events Calendar. Don't schedule events, but know someone who does? Invite them to add their events. If we all work together, we can create another wonderful resource for the Jewish community. Visit our calendar and post your events at jcastnetwork.org/JCEC.
The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Shower. I'm your host, Herschel Finn, and we are getting ready for the Passover holiday, which is the end of this week. In this half hour of the show, we'll be featuring a best of with author Sarah Lipton, who wrote a book called Dark Mirror, Jewish Iconography, very appropriate for the time that we're having. Next week, by the way, since it is Sunday, is a holiday, so the show will be broadcast, but we will just be playing music. I won't be here. I'll be enjoying the holiday. There is no portion of the week. It is usurped this week and next week by the holiday of Passover. And so this week we're going to talk about Passover. Next week we're not going to talk about anything because I'm not going to be here after that. We have an awesome story at the end of the hour, all the way at the end, but right before the 12 o'clock. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Jerusalem police arrested two 12-year-old Arabs for planning a terrorist attack. Police found two knives and a meat cleaver concealed in the coat of one of them with a farewell note to his parents. The kids are currently in police custody and most likely will be turned over to their parents so they can go do it again. A military court indicted Elor Azaria, the soldier who shot an injured terrorist in Hebron last month, as indicted with manslaughter. Earlier this week, the soldier testified in court that he heard someone shouting, "Be careful, he has a bomb on him." Egypt gave Saudi Arabia, Tehran, and Sanafir, two islands at the opening of the Gulf of Aqaba. The plan is for the Saudis to build a bridge to Egypt. Israel was consulted about the deal and trusts the Saudis will maintain the status quo, as the straits are the only way to get from Eilat into the Indian Ocean. It was pointed out to me that one of the reasons for the Six-Day War back in 1967 was because the Egyptians and the Saudis were planning on blockading the Indian Ocean. Some other news. Vladimir Groysman, keep your eye on this person, was appointed Prime Minister of Ukraine by President Petro Poroshenko. Groysman is the first openly Jewish person to hold the country's second highest office and at 38, the youngest person to ever hold a job. Ukraine has a Jewish population of 360,000 people. The U.S. Navy is naming a destroyer for former Michigan Senator Carl Levin. Yay, go Carl. The destroyer, I don't know if I would name a destroyer after Carl Levin. He just doesn't seem like the destroyer type. I would name maybe, I don't know, I'm not going to go there. The destroyer is capable of fighting air, surface, and subsurface battles simultaneously. And finally, in some real good news, especially for the 33 people that this happened to, 33 hikers were rescued from floodwaters in Israel's south. The flash floods isolated the hikers from being able to reach the road. In related news, two girls from Lubavitch High School in Miami disappeared last Shabbos as their school was on a trip to Orlando. The teens were found the next day, stranded in a swamp several miles from their hotel. Everything worked out. That's good. That's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in a growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, and visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Why go anywhere else when you could go to One Stop Kosher? Located on Greenfield Road, just south of 696, you're never far from One Stop Kosher. At One Stop Kosher, you'll find the largest selection of kosher wines in Michigan. One Stop Kosher has the freshest produce, the best dairy, deli, and meats, their gourmet. They even have a kosher bakery right on the premise. It's One Stop Kosher on Greenfield Road in 696 for all your shopping needs. Herschel Finman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. We are online with Professor from Stony Brook, SUNY Stony Brook, Sarah Lipton, has written a book called Dark Mirror, Medieval Origins of Anti-Jewish Iconography. How are you today, Sarah?
I'm very well, thanks.
Oh, good to hear. Thank you so much for taking up your time and coming on and telling you about this subject. The word iconography, let's start with this. We're going to be very, very basic. Let's start, first of all, a lot of people, when they think the word icon, especially if they're probably under 20, are thinking those things that you click on your computer screen. So let's start with what's an icon and what's iconography and what's negative, like anti-Jewish iconography. It's a three-part question.
Okay, sure. Iconography is the study of medieval symbols. An icon is a symbol. And people click on icons on their computer because somebody realized that it's a lot easier to just look at a picture, very quickly grasp its meaning, and trash can means that you're getting rid of something. So symbols, visual symbols are very meaningful, and iconography is the study of the meaning of visual symbols. I study anti-Jewish visual symbols in medieval Christian art. I use the word anti-Jewish rather than anti-Semitic. There's a big debate in my field about which term is most appropriate. Both of them signal disapproval of Jews, but anti-Jewish is usually used by medieval historians to mean disapproval of the ideas and beliefs of Judaism and the people who follow Judaism. Anti-Semitism has more of a racialist and ethnic flavor, which many people think did develop by the end of the Middle Ages, but really seems not to be present for the early and middle part of the Middle Ages, so that's why I don't use that term as a rule.
Okay, that clarifies that. Now, I did a little bit of research and for the interview, went online, and in typing the word anti-Jewish iconography, the only listing that really came up was your book. In typing up medieval iconology, the only thing that came up were basically universities and their programs that they had in it. This is a scholarly subject, a thick subject. Why the need for the book Dark Mirror then, Sarah Lipton?
Oh, well, I think there's a need for the book precisely because, as you say, there's really not enough talk and information out with the general public about the meaning of visual symbols. We are saturated with visual symbols. For people these days, you know, you can't turn around without seeing a moving billboard or pictures. Increasingly, our students want to be taught through PowerPoint rather than just through listening or through reading things. We're surrounded by images, and yet there's relatively little explanation about the way images work and little analysis of the way you find meaning in images. And I particularly think it's important because we have seen, in the past few years, such a powerful and really disturbing demonstration of the emotional impact that images can have. I don't think Jews really need to be taught this because I think they understand that anti-Jewish caricatures, anti-Jewish imagery in cartoons, most notably used by the Nazis, were incredibly destructive. But this is becoming sort of very generally known. Whether you agree with the response or not, it's very clear that people in the Muslim world are upset by representations of Muhammad. People among various minority communities are beginning to pay attention to how very destructive stereotypical representations of various groups can be. So I think it's extremely important. My own field is medieval Jewish-Christian relations, so I wanted to write a book about what I know best, the way Christians show Jews, and then to talk about how those images affected the way people thought about Jews.
Mm-hmm. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Professor Sarah Lipton, who's written a book called Dark Mirror, The Medieval Origins of Anti-Jewish Iconography. The question that jumps out at me, I'm looking at your book, is actually, I think it's like the first line of your book, that there wasn't any anti-Jewish iconography before about the year 1050. And my first thought was, how do you know? If you didn't find, you know, it's like, did you, how, it's like, it's hard to say that it didn't exist because it wasn't there. So how do you know that there wasn't anything? I mean, there's not a whole lot of anything that we know about from 1050.
Well, yeah, that is a very good question. Obviously, we all worry about how hard it is to make an argument from absence. But I took about 8.5 years to write this book. I spent the better part of those 8.5 years traveling around Europe, looking at churches, looking at artworks, looking at illuminated manuscripts, trawling libraries, going through every catalog of medieval images that I could find. And there are none of the signs that became so distressingly familiar from the later Middle Ages appear in artworks from the early Middle Ages. We do have artworks from the early Middle Ages, not as many as from later periods, but we do have some. I cannot say, of course, that nothing ever existed, but I can say that if the symbols that I find in later medieval art were used in the earlier medieval period, then they must have been very, very, very rare examples, because medieval artists were not original. They didn't seek originality, they sought familiarity. They really saw art as a form of conveying messages, not as a form of personal self-expression. They wanted the symbols they used to be familiar and readable to people. So I think it's extremely unlikely that some artists used symbols that didn't really make it into the general catalog that we have left. And I should argue this is not my own observation alone. One or two other people have written on anti-Jewish art before, and they agreed that anti-Jewish art really did not exist before. We disagree on the dates, but before the middle part of the Middle Ages, whether it's 1050 or 1100 or 1200.
Okay, so what all of a sudden happened at 1050 that suddenly there's something that can be described as anti-Jewish, and how did it manifest itself at that point, Sarah Lipton?
Yes, well, in some ways I feel hesitant by saying that around 1050 art became anti-Jewish. That, in fact, is not what I found. What I found is that in the middle decades of the 11th century, Christian artists started marking Jews in a way that made them recognizable as Jews, or I should say Judaic figures, but not, in fact, in negative ways. What we start seeing is that a certain kind of headgear, pointed hats, are shown on various Judaic figures, Hebrew prophets, the elders and priests discussed in the New Testament. Within a few decades, sometimes they would show scenes from contemporary medieval life, for example, illustrating maybe an event in a saint's life, and Jewish figures from those legends would be shown wearing pointed hats. Also, the beard became a symbol, but these were overwhelmingly not negative images, especially with the Hebrew prophets. They were treated with a great deal of respect. Christians considered Hebrew scripture to be revelation from God. They never denigrated it. And so I had to try and understand, what did these symbols mean? And doing a lot of reading, seeing what they said about such symbols, seeing other ways they used the symbol, looking at the symbol in context, I concluded that the pointed hat and the beard were used as signs of antiquity, the ancient world, which Christians very much respected and revered, priestly or royal authority or wisdom, a kind of official status, a kind of intellectual power, and eventually kind of a whiff of Easternness, because they associated antiquity and authority of that kind with the Eastern Mediterranean, with the Byzantine world, and with the ancient Near East. So they started showing Hebrew prophets with these symbols in order to show that the artworks in which these Hebrew prophets appeared had the legitimacy of antique authority. And what really happened, it was not that they were changing attitudes towards Jews. It's not that overnight in the middle of the 11th century they started hating Jews more. It's that Christians were thinking differently about their own religion. They were thinking much more seriously about the connection between what they called the new law brought by Jesus and the old law, which had been given by God to Moses, and they were trying to work out what that connection was, and so they decided they needed symbols for the old, the past, so they could then contrast them with symbols of the new for the present, and so they came up with the pointed hat versus the bare head, and with the beard versus the shaven chin as a way of visually contrasting old and new.
Okay, I can understand the beard, because religious Jews till this day wear beards. Were Jews in the 1100s wearing pointy hats in that way? If somebody looking at this could say, oh, Jews wear those, and me being a Christian, I don't wear those, and therefore this must be a picture of a Jew?
Well, that was the assumption of scholars for years and years and years, that they were just using the pointed hat because that's what Jews wore. And I did an enormous amount of research and reading, both in Jewish texts and in Christian texts, and I can find absolutely zero evidence that Jews wore that kind of hat, or frankly, that Jews wore any kind of hat at all. It does not seem to have been the practice for religious Jews to cover their heads on a regular basis until after the end of the Middle Ages, until the 16th century, wearing the kippah or some form of headgear became common. Before that, occasionally it seems that Jews covered their heads when they prayed, but again, there's no evidence that they covered their heads with distinctive-looking hats, and certainly not with pointed hats. And as a matter of fact, we have a lot of texts, both Jewish and Christian, that say very clearly, you cannot tell a Jew by looking at one. Jews do not have any kind of distinctive clothing in any way. Eventually, that became seen by Christian authorities as a problem, but in the 11th and 12th centuries, that was simply a given.
Okay, so now, your research, where in Europe did it take you? Are we talking England, France, Germany, or are we talking around the Mediterranean Rim, or are we talking Middle Europe? Where did you go for all this?
Yeah, I did my research all over Western Europe. So the furthest east I got was really Austria and some eastern parts of Germany. I did my research in Austria, Germany, Italy, Spain, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, and England. I stuck to Western Europe primarily because medieval historians feel we need to do our research in primary sources in languages we know, and I know Western European languages. I don't know Central or Eastern European languages. It's a big regret of mine. I would love to quickly pick up Polish and Czech and Russian and see that side of the story, but that's easier said than done.
Indeed. Now, so let me then ask you, I can understand, okay, so maybe Spanish in Italy, Greece, there might be a need for some sort of an indication that this is a Jewish person, but if you're talking England, France, Germany, they're primarily Nordic, have different features than Jews, so all you have to do to discern the difference between a European and a Jew is draw someone who have a Nordic feature versus somebody of Semitic features, and voila, there you are.
Well, the interesting thing about that is that, in fact, in the very countries where you would think there might be a need for using distinguishing signs, they were much less typically used, and they only came in later, so that Italian and Spanish art, where, as you say, Jews look very much like the surrounding populations, they tended not to use the pointed hat and the beard. Whereas in the northern European countries, where you might think it was less necessary, that is where the signs were introduced and where they became widespread. So one of the main arguments of my book is that medieval Christian art is not showing the world around them. It's not about the world around them. Medieval Christian art is doing something very different. It's trying to deliver a spiritual message, a religious message, an ideological message. It's thinking about the other world, whether it's heaven or an alternate universe in some way. It's really not reportage. Another point, though, it's quite interesting. You would think that Jews could be distinguished from the surrounding population in northern European countries, and it seems not to have been the case. So, again, we have Christian texts, especially a text issued by council convened by Pope that says, in many countries around Western Christendom, you cannot tell a Jew by looking at one, and in those countries, they should impose some kind of distinguishing clothing. This was rather late in the game. This was in the year 1215, so it seems a long time ago to non-medievalists, but to medievalists, that's rather late in the game. And the countries that did issue those rules were northern France, and England, and some places in Germany. So it seems very clear that you really could not be sure you were looking at a Jew, even in those areas where you would think there would be some kind of physiological difference. And the answer is that, first of all, of course, some Jews are dark and distinctive looking, but many are not. There was quite a bit more, I wouldn't say intermarriage, because that, of course, was disapproved of by both Jewish and Christian religious authorities. But there was more intermingling, including sexual intermingling, than any of the authorities were happy about. And clearly, there were Jews who did not look the stereotypical way at all. We have governmental records that talk about Aaron the blonde Jew. There were blonde Jews. There might have been blue-eyed Jews. Of course, there were very dark people in Northern Europe, either through forms of immigration or because of the luck of the genetic draw. So clearly some Jews would have been identifiable as such, but many other Jews were not identifiable as such, and there were also non-Jews who might have been mistaken for Jews. So things were not visually clear-cut in the real world. And one of my arguments is that art tries to make things visually clear-cut in order to improve upon the real-world situation.
Okay. Now, I'm not an art historian. My wife is the art historian. At what point, Sarah Lipton, did the art take on the negative anti-Semitic connotation, and was it the art that caused the anti-Semitism or the anti-Semitism that caused the art?
I have to look very, very carefully to try and figure out when the negative turn came, and then obviously think about why. And I would place sort of two stages in the negative turn. In the 1160s and the 1170s, you start seeing much more negative-looking pictures of Jews, so that Jews start having distorted features, big noses or bent noses, but even more than that, scowling, hostile, aggressive facial expressions, so that clearly the Jews start looking at, like bad guys in art, especially in Germany in the 1160s and the 1170s. I do not think that it was caused by pre-existing, clear-cut, widespread increase in anti-Semitism. Now, there are beginnings of anti-Jewish texts being written in this period, but in general, if you read scholarship on medieval Jewish existence, these are really flourishing years for medieval Jewish communities. I mean, these are the years of the great Tosafistic commentaries. This is a time of enormous religious and intellectual creativity and energy, and Jews were also doing extremely well economically in this period. So the anti-Jewish texts we see from this period are kind of a small voice of rather conservative theologians beginning to say, wait a minute, the success of the Jewish communities is not in line with what our religious theology says it should be. So we do see anti-Jewish texts, but I don't think those texts are what's causing the images. I looked very carefully at the images, and all of these scowling, exaggerated Jewish faces appear in very specific visual contexts. These scowling Jewish faces are looking away from a newfangled image of Jesus, so that up until about this period, Jesus tended to be shown as very successful, triumphant, well-dressed, alive and healthy on the cross, wearing a crown, and they called him Jesus the King, Jesus the Warrior. The idea of Jesus that was dominant in the population was a powerful, godlike figure. But it was around this time that some Christian mystics especially started thinking of Jesus in new ways. They stressed the fact that he was a God-man, and they were more interested in the man part, and they stressed the fact that he suffered, that he was vulnerable, that he had love for his people, and they were trying to encourage their flocks to feel love and compassion and pity for him in his mortality and humanity. And so they encouraged artists to show Jesus as human and mortal. But we know from various texts that a lot of Christians were shocked by this new way of showing their God. They thought, that doesn't look like a God. That's a naked, suffering man. That is ugly. That is humiliating. That's not our idea of a religious image. And so the Christian thinkers were trying to change the way viewers looked at those images. And my argument is that they put in pictures of nasty, scowling, angry Jews either glaring at Jesus or turning away from his suffering with a lack of compassion in order to use Jews as counter models for the Christian viewers to say, look, don't react in that way. Don't have contempt for his suffering or his humiliation, or you will be looking like a Jew. And once I got that idea, I started reading as widely as I could in Christian texts. And in fact, I did find Christian texts that said exactly that. If you look at Christ without compassion, you are looking like a Jew. So that is very, very negative. I wouldn't yet call it anti-Semitic in that the Jews' distorted features are not stable, they're not realistic, they don't seem to be saying this is the way Jews look in real life. They seem to be saying this is the moral way Jews would look if we could see into their souls. But eventually these images had an impact. Little by little, the idea that Jews had distorted features became kind of standardized to one very stable and much more realistic anti-Jewish caricature, or I could even call it an anti-Semitic caricature. We see faces by the year 1250 in Christian art that could be straight out of and obviously directly influenced Nazi anti-Semitic propaganda. The same face with kind of a big hooked nose, dark scowling hair, a pointed dark beard, fleshy lips, heavy brows. This became the face of the Jew in Christian caricature, and it would remain stable from about 1250, unfortunately, all the way until today. You can still see such anti-Jewish caricatures in propaganda created by anti-Semitic groups.
That was one of my questions, actually, I was going to ask you about that. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Professor Sarah Lipton, who has written the book Dark Mirror, The Medieval Origins of Anti-Jewish Iconography. Was most of this art, I'm led to believe, church-related art? We're talking stained glass, murals, frescoes, that type of stuff?
Sarah? Most of this art, almost all of the art I discuss, is Christian religious art. For the first half of my period, meaning from about 1000 to about 1250, it was church-related. It was manuscripts made for the liturgical use or for perhaps for monastic use. It was stained glass. It was carving. It was wall painting. Around the year 1250, Europe is becoming much more commercialized, and we have a growing lay, non-religious middle class, and the elites are commissioning works of art for private use. So increasingly after 1250, 1300, we see works of art made for lay people and not just for church context, but it's still religious art.
Okay, I'm glad we clarified that. One question that's always bothered me is the origin of the Jewish star. There's a lot of talk about that it's really not a Jewish symbol at all. Do you know anything about the Jewish star, Sarah?
The Jewish star was used in the ancient world, and it was not exclusively a Jewish symbol at all, but it was also used by Jews. We can see it decorating Hellenistic synagogues, for example. It was not used as a symbol of Jewishness either by Jews or by Christians about Jews with any kind of consistency until, I think, the 13th century, and certainly becomes fairly well known in the 14th century. But there was a long period when it was not the main symbol of Judaism at all. Why it came back, I haven't yet been able to figure out, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The one chapter I have, which is really intriguing, I'm going to have to wrap it up after this, because we're running out of time. Unfortunately, I could talk for a lot more time on this, is you devote a whole chapter to where are women. So where are women in medieval anti-Jewish iconography, Sarah Lipton?
This was such an interesting part of my research. I realized after I wrote the first few chapters that every single Jewish figure I discussed, without exception, was male. And the name of the chapter comes from the question I asked myself, where are the Jewish women? Meaning not that no women were ever shown in Christian works of art who should be thought of as Jewish. I mean, when they illustrated the Old Testament, well, we see the Old Testament figures, Sarah, Miriam, etc. When they illustrated the New Testament, we saw some of the New Testament figures. I mean, obviously the Virgin Mary herself, although they tended not to think of her as Jewish. But figures like Salome, who was sort of a Jewish villainess in Christian imagination, none of these figures are shown looking at all different from Christian women. They are blonde, they are beautiful, they are dressed like courtly noble women, and in very stark contrast to the way Jewish men began to be shown in the later 1100s and on. So I tried to figure out why, and I did find out that there was a change, that Jewish women begin to be visually marked as different from Christian women around the year 1400. They're marked in two ways. You sort of have a fork in the road with Jewish women. On the one hand, you have this gorgeous, exotic, jewel-wearing, brightly colored clothing-wearing, seductive Jewess. And they always called her the Jewess, and they had all sorts of legends about the beautiful Jewess who seduced the Christian man. She was usually villainous, although not always. Sometimes it's a beautiful Jewess who is seduced by a Christian man and who converts to Christianity. That's the prototype for the figure Jessica in The Merchant of Venice. Or you had a horrible Jewish hag who basically looked like a Jewish man with long hair, sometimes even wearing the pointed hat, which no woman would have done on the streets of late medieval Europe. So I tried to think, why? Why are Jewesses kind of invisible as such until 1400, and why do they become visible afterwards? And as was the case with Jewish men, the answer lies in changes in Christian culture and religion rather than changes in Jewish practice. What happens is around the year 1400, the site of Christian observance and the location where Christianity is most practiced and to which Christian moralists pay attention moves from the church to the household. And instead of talking only about priests and ceremonies in church, they talk about families, mothers and fathers, wives and husbands, and how they practice Christianity and how they should teach their children. And as wives and mothers become very, very important figures in Christianity, the importance of the Christian woman goes up and up and up and up and up, they start again using Jewish women as these counterexamples. So they're now contrasting Christian women with Jewish women. They didn't do that earlier because, quite frankly, Christian women were not even on the radar screen for most Christian priests and theologians before this turned to what they called lay piety.
Oh, absolutely wonderful. Okay, that's going to do it for us. Again, our guest today has been SUNY, it's the University of New York at Stony Brook professor, Sarah Lipton, written a book called Dark Mirror, is the authority on the medieval origins of anti-Jewish iconography. And I want to thank you so much, Sarah, for coming on and enlightening us. I just feel my brain has indeed gotten bigger today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Okay, take care. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Stop paying more than your fair share of property tax now. I'm Stephen Poulter, attorney at law and president of Express Property Tax Appeals. Right now, your commercial property tax assessments are in the mail. Like many commercial property owners, you're probably paying unnecessary and exorbitant property taxes, potentially costing you hundreds of thousands of dollars every year. Express Property Tax Appeals can help. I recently reduced one of my clients' property tax values by $2 million, realizing $250,000 in real tax dollar savings. I can do the same for you. If you're a commercial property owner, manager, or broker and are tired of paying more than your fair share of property tax, call Express Property Tax Appeals now at 855-LOW-TAX-9 or online at lowtax9.com. That's 855-LOW-TAX-9 or online at lowtax9.com. You have nothing to lose except your looming property tax burden. I'm Stephen Poulter with Express Property Tax Appeals, and I look forward to saving you money on your property taxes.
The Art Studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the Art Studio of Oak Park has something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Art Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Art Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have a couple public service announcements. First of all, there will be a Yom HaShoah commemoration. That's Holocaust Memorial Day, Commemoration Day. That's going to be Sunday, May 1st. That's the day after Passover at 2 p.m. at the Holocaust Memorial Center in Farmington Hills. For more information, call 248-553-2400. On May 10th, the Federation is hosting Israel Yom HaZikaron, Israeli Memorial Day. That's for the lost soldiers. This is Tuesday, May the 10th at 6 p.m. at the Berman Center on the JCC campus. And that's open to the public, and there's no need to RSVP or call anybody. But that's that. If your organization is having a function and you'd like to have it announced here free of charge, send info to me at www.rabbifinman.com and we'll tell all the world about it absolutely free because that's what public service announcements are. Up next, for your listening pleasure, this is Baruch Shalom, new on the Jewish music recording scene. And this song is written as an expression of a prayer for having your material needs met by the Almighty. It's called Poseach Es Yodecha, Open Up Your Hand, with a capital Y.
Thank you.
Want assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's a symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Herschel Finman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. We're having lots of fun. It's music time. It's Passover this week, and we're going to play something a little bit Pesach-ex. This is actually Chup Kazak, and this is the Minsk Kapella. Someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968. MDS Drug Detox.
Herr Schulfinan, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have time for one more song. Every Seder, the Passover feast, ends with a traditional song. I don't know how old this song is, per se, or even the tunes that are picked for it. I have a CD in our archives, which actually has 24 different versions of this song, sung in different ways. The song is called Chagiga, and being that, what does it talk about? The idea is that the father goes to the market and buys a goat, a young kid, for the Paschal lamb. And there's a whole series of events that happen, and finally culminating with the coming of Mashiach. That's the it's enough that it's nice that we're doing things. We're communal. We have a sacrifice if we had a temple. But that's not what we're here for. It's like you hear, we didn't come here just to play. We came to win. So the winning is with the Mashiach coming. So this is the Israeli Boys Town Choir singing Chagiga. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Hey, Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. This week is the holiday of Passover. There is so much to say and so little time to say it. Let's just review things that have to be. It is customary to get rid of one's chametz before the holiday of Passover. That would mean in the Detroit area before 12:15-ish. It's like 12:20-something, but just if you're done, if your chametz is put away, it is customary the night before Passover to put down 10 small pieces of leavening. We at the Finman House use macaroni because it doesn't crumble. It's very small. We wrap it up in tissue paper. Someone writes down where all the 10 pieces are, so in case one of them doesn't get found, because if you don't find all 10 pieces, you have to keep searching until you do, because you know it's there. We then take the 10 pieces, you're supposed to search with a candle, we take them and we put them aside, and the next morning they are burned, incinerated, while saying a statement on disavowing any ownership of any leavened grain. Leavening is anything comprised of wheat, barley, oat, rye, spelt, and oats, which is mixed with water and allowed to ferment, which means any grain product, basically, except for matzo or matzo products, have to be gone for the whole 8 days. Then it is a mitzvah to consume matzah on Friday night. That means night. Night in Detroit next week, the earliest that you could eat your matzah and have it counted as being for night is at about 10 to 9 p.m. The best matzah to use, I'm not saying that there's matzah that's not good to use, because if it's matzah and it says on the box, kosher for Passover, that's okay. But there's matzah, and then there's primo matzah. And the primo matzah is shmura matzah. Shmura matzah is handmade, first of all. There's no machines. There's no chance that any dough got stuck in anything, because there isn't anything to get stuck in. You might say, well, maybe there's dough on people's hands. Well, they wash them constantly. And the flour itself, from the time of the harvest until the time that it's the kneading, is guarded to make sure that it never came in contact with any moisture whatsoever. And the matzahs are baked within a period of 18 minutes, so there's really no chance. This is the best thing to use for Passover, especially for the two seders. If you do not have any, I would say drop me a line at rabbifinman.com, and we will arrange to get you some. That's what we're here for. We're here to help people. The idea of a Seder is a discussion. A Haggadah is not a pure prayer book. The Haggadah is the outline which we use to spur on discussion for the Seder. There are those people, like, for example, my grandfather, what he would do is we'd all sit down, and he would just read the whole thing. And I had no idea what was going on. I was 8 years old when my grandfather passed away. So I actually remember being about 3 years old. So I remember about five seders with my grandfather, and I remember them being exceedingly boring. I would go and, like, count the designs in my grandmother's bathroom wallpaper. That's how bad it was. I would come into the kitchen where my grandmother was, like, preparing food, and I'd say to her, Bubby, can I help you? And she'd say, no, darling, go in and enjoy the seder. And it's like, you got to be kidding. So that's not the way to do it. It's supposed to be a discussion. It starts out with four questions. A little kid says questions. We gear the Seder around questions and discussion, because it's only by discussing things that we come to a conclusion. And what are we concluding? That we need to go out of our own personal Egypts. Every day, it says, we have to consider ourselves as though we personally left Egypt. That we left the limitations of what was holding us back from accomplishing. Because again, ultimately, just like the song Haggadah that we just played, when is it that we have to stop going out of our limitations? When there are no more limitations. When is that? When the Mashiach comes. Let's just hope he comes right before the next commercial break is done. You're listening to the Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard from the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor the Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for the Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep the Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to the Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
listening to the Jewish Hour. If you want to get in touch with me, the way to do that is go to my website, rabbifinman.com, www.rabbifinman. We also have a new site, jewishferndale.com, which is another affiliated program that is under the same umbrella group. So you can go to jewishferndale.com and see what's doing over there in Ferndale. Good things happening there. If what will you find on rabbifinman.com? Well, you'll find archive editions of the show. You'll find a way to contact me, of course. You'll find archived editions of the E-Parsha, U-Parsha, Hasidic U-Story. You can contact me about selling your chametz before Passover. Do that. You're supposed to do that as a way of getting rid of anything that you want to keep. You can't own. You have to give it. You have to sell it. Give it away. Eat it. So you sell it. You can authorize me to sell it for you. No salesman will call. And we'll take care of all of that. And you'll also find the very important donations page. We're almost there. We're almost finished paying for April. We need you to come through. Go to rabbifinman.com. Give a small donation. Doesn't have to be grandiose. Do it in honor of Passover. Do it in honor of your next-door neighbor. Just go do it. Don't like doing internet giving? Understood. Drop your contribution of any amount to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. And we greatly appreciate it and greatly acknowledge all gifts till now and all those in the future. The story involves a chassid of the previous generation. His name was Chai Kalchan. I'm not sure about this Chai Kalchan in person. The stories that I hear about him are amazing. He was a wealthy businessman. He had a factory in Russia, which was confiscated during the Bolshevik Revolution. But he still always seemed to have money. And there's lots and lots and lots of stories where people came to him and he was able to get money. He managed to make it out of, after World War II, on the transports that were smuggling Russian Jews through Poland into Paris. And eventually he made it to New York. I know some of his grandchildren. So there's a story that Heichel was in Paris, and he was living in an apartment building that was owned by a certain Zalman Schneerson. Zalman Schneerson was one of the closest relatives to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I believe he was a second cousin. I also know some of his grand. I was in yeshiva with some of his grandchildren. So it once happened that in the middle, right before Passover, when everybody's running around doing whatever they're doing, this Zalman Schneerson called Heichel into his apartment and said, "My wife and I need to have a case adjudicated, and we want you to do it." So he started to protest, "I am not a judge. I don't know how to do money matters." He says, this Rabbi Schneerson said, "You appreciate money matters. You deal with money all the time." She says, "So what's the problem?" The wife, Mrs. Schneerson, went first. She says, "It's time to prepare for Passover. My husband tells me he's got no money." I says, "What about money for matzah?" He says, "We don't have money for a crumb." She says, "But I saw you had an envelope that was filled with what looked to be around $5,000. What happened to the money?" She says, "At least you could have..." So he said, this is Rabbi Schneerson, said, "Well, it's true. There was a person who I did some work for, and he paid me this money, $5,000. But as soon as I got the money into my pocket, so another person came up to me. His family is destitute. They're getting kicked out of their apartment. They need to move out of their apartment. They need to find another apartment. They need this. They need that. They need that. They need $5,000. He said, "Wow, what a coincidence. I handed him the money." So Chai Kalchan said, "That's very commendable that you gave all that money to charity." But the woman said, "Yeah, but you could have taken out some for yourself, that we should have our own needs." So for this, Rabbi Schneerson had no answer. So this Chai Kalchan thought for a minute, and he said, "You know what? This is a tremendous thing that your husband did, and I would have done exactly the same thing. But, Mrs. Schneerson, you're right. You need money too. So this is what I'm going to do." He said, "I will undertake all of your expenses for Passover. And in exchange, I want half of the mitzvah that Rabbi Schneerson received for giving away this money. And that's the way it worked. And everybody was happy. The Rebbetzin got to make Pesach. The rabbi got to give away the money that for this needy family. And Haikal Chanan got himself half a mitzvah. I suppose half a mitzvah is better than none. That's going to do it. We want to wish you a happy and a healthy Passover. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. For those who are not Jewish, we'll see you next week. And for those of you who are Jewish, we'll see you in too. Take care.